Last year, some intrepid Alaskans decided to explore our food security by limiting their diet to local food for a year. And the first thing you find out is you need a root cellar. And the second, you need to be starting right now on your growing season. And the snow's still falling. Good morning and welcome to Talk of Alaska. I'm Steve Heimel. The subject today is extending the food season. Our number 1-800-478-8255, 478-TALK, a local call in Anchorage at 550-8422, email talk@alaskapublic.org. We'll have some success stories in a moment on Talk of Alaska statewide.
Today's program is underwritten in part by ConocoPhillips. The easy oil is gone, and getting to the remaining oil will be a challenge that will require the state and the industry to work together. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company.
And by
the Pebble Partnership, developing a comprehensive mine plan that meets Alaska's regulatory requirements while supporting sustainable fisheries in southwest Alaska. PebblePartnership.com. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of APRN, this station, or its underwriters.
Well, this is going to be a little bit of a different show because the President of the United States is still on the air in most of our radio stations. So if you're listening to this show, you may be one of the few radio stations that is carrying this instead of the President of the United States. How about that? But stations will be joining the show in progress. And our subject is basically problems of the short growing season in Alaska and what can be done about it. The Alaska Botanical Garden is holding its sixth annual Spring Garden Conference this week into the weekend. And the theme is Extend the Season, Expand Your Mind. And this has been a phenomenally successful gardening conference. The public interest seems to be huge. And we will be hearing from a couple of the people who will be appearing at the conference and also with the Botanical Gardens Executive Director, Julianne McGinnis. Welcome to Talk of Alaska, Julianne.
Thanks, Steve.
It's good to have you back with us here and in your capacity instead of as a public broadcasting person in Talkeetna.
I'm on the other side of the table.
You are indeed. So how's it feel over there?
It's great to be here.
Oh, good. Good. Well, you must feel pretty proud. This conference is become huge.
It sure has. Gardening has become huge. You know, gardening is a hot topic increasingly, and growing food, growing vegetables, fruits, and herbs. So,
yeah. So this time around, you invited Elia Coleman, and he said yes. And so let's try and get him connected to us from Maine, where he is, and about to leave for Alaska. Elliot, welcome to Talk of Alaska.
Hi, Steve. It's nice to talk to you from way down here.
Yeah, way down. Elliot, one of the things that I assume you'll be talking about, because you always do, is high tunnels and the fact that even in northern latitudes, we really can't extend the season. Why don't you kind of just give us a really brief version of your pitch?
Sure. Well, what we found out, we sort of stumbled on it, is that you get a great deal of protection from an unheated high tunnel. But if you put a second layer of translucent protection inside that, a foot above the ground, so you basically have a greenhouse inside a greenhouse, you've moved yourself a considerable distance to the south. And in our case here on the Maine coast, we move from Zone 5 Maine to Zone 8 Georgia for free just by having two layers of protection.
The way I put it when I did the promo for the show is there's a wonders what a little visqueen can do. Is that what it is, just a heavy visqueen?
Well, it's greenhouse plastic. And the interesting thing about this, I've always thought that new ideas begin in the least likely spot. And Maine, having some pretty cold winters for the lower 48, is a pretty unlikely spot for this idea to begin. But since it began here, people to the south say, oh my gosh, you know, if he can do it, I guess we can. Now, you guys are the only ones further north of us who are going to say, oh yeah, maybe they can do that way down there, but we can't do it way up here. And I don't believe that. I've never believed anything was impossible. We just have to figure out how to do it.
Wow. So let's get this straight. You're at about, what, 44, and we're up here at 60 or so.
Yep. I've always thought you could do this up to about the 62nd parallel.
Is that right? Well, I think that's Bethel is just about there. Let's call on our third guest here, to give us the view from Bethel. as soon as I can get my paperwork together here. Tim Myers?
Good morning.
How are you?
Fine. How are you?
Oh, I'm not too bad. I'm glad you could join us from Myers Farm in Bethel. How did your plans work out, Tim, for selling some of your produce from Bethel in Anchorage? Did that pan out?
Well, that panned out good for last year, and I got rid of what I had to, or what I needed to get rid of. But I don't have. We had an extremely cold summer last year, coldest summer we've ever had. And though we grew a lot of stuff, we didn't grow enough that I could be shipping any to Anchorage. That would have shortchanged everybody out here.
So
I didn't send anything in there this winter.
Well, you do have rather a large root cellar. How is your stock of materials holding up?
Good. We actually harvested about 22,000 pounds of various crops last fall. We've been selling. We have a market on the farm that we have open every Wednesday afternoon and every Saturday morning, and we've sold quite a bit of that. We have plenty to last us into the spring. We should have potatoes to sell up to harvest time next fall.
I am still eating my potatoes from last summer, and I'm very happy to have a cool place that they're not sprouting.
Yeah.
They're not sprouting out too much. Tim Myers, Myers Farm, how many acres do you have producing now?
Well, we've opened up 17 acres now. We're not have it all under cultivation at this time. We probably have three or four, but we opened up another five last year. It's going to take me a year or two to get that all drained and thawed and put into production.
Now, you have, the last time I had you on, you were just raving about how great the soil is there. You still feeling that way?
I do. This is all brand new virgin ground that I open up, and basically within a year, adding some fish to it, I'm doing everything organically. Things seem to grow as well as can be expected in this climate. I don't have any problems getting things to grow. I think this soil seems to be very adaptable to agriculture.
So right at this point, I mean, you're probably dealing with temperatures close to, like 10 degrees or so, pretty much the same temperature really that Elliot's got in Maine this morning. But are you taking steps already to get plants started and so forth?
Oh, yeah. I've got a lot of stuff started already. I got a high tunnel. Was my second season with a high tunnel last spring, and I was impressed that I vividly remember taking a small tiller into that high tunnel in March last year and was able to till that ground. And, you know, anything else that I have outside, I even have a hard time getting a tiller in it in May. So that really opened up what I was thinking about. And now after reading some of the information that Elliot's put out, I think we have a lot of potential for doing a lot of this stuff a lot earlier than I have been.
Do you have a question you want to pose to Elliot right now? He's on the other line.
I've got questions, but I think I'll wait till this weekend to talk to him.
Okay, well, that's great. And Elliot, I'm going to have one for you, but I'm going to pose it first to Julianne. And it's coming over the internet from Susan, who says, I am trying to get succession plantings and it ain't working out. She says, for instance, spinach. The second crop just don't do well. Is there something I'm doing wrong?
So you're posing that to me?
I am.
Well, I've been gardening in Alaska for many years.
I know.
you know that. I would say it depends when you're trying to plant spinach. For one thing, it's prone to bolting, so it depends what variety you're trying to plant here. And
yeah, she didn't explain exactly why it didn't work out, but I'm assuming that it's bolting, and probably that has to do with the photoperiod.
Yeah, photoperiod and possibly temperature as well, and variety, yeah.
Yeah, it's about all we can do. Elliot, you got any tricks you might want to pass on to Susan, who is, I'm not even sure which part of Alaska she is in, but she'd like to crop some things, get two crops during the short growing season. Any potential for varieties or things that she might try that she could plant after she pulled one early crop out, like, say, spinach?
Yeah, well, I'm quite sure you guys know a lot more about the spinach varieties for Alaska than I do, but very often when people fail with the second and third crops when they're trying to do succession plantings, it's because it's a little drier by then, and they got away with a lot on the first planting because the soil was moist enough, and we suggest to people that they water the bed or the field every day until the crop germinates. And then, by then it's often going and you got it made. But if it dries out and those seeds don't get enough moisture when they're lying under the ground there, you won't get a good stand.
Yeah, they just sit there. We had another question from Susie who said, hey, you guys didn't explain what a high tunnel is yet. So I guess we'll leave that one to you, Elliot. You've kind of been spreading the gospel of high tunnel. And is this something that it says here that you kind of came across this as a serious food production system in Europe?
Well, the Europeans and the Asians have acres and acres covered with what you can call high tunnels. You can call them hoop houses. You can call them pipe frame greenhouses. They look like Quonset huts with metal ribs and covered with a sheet of plastic. So that's basically what high tunnel means. High tunnel because it's tall enough for you to walk in there. I first saw this technology being used extensively in Europe, and this is back in the early 70s when I was first fortunate enough to go over there. And I suspect something was being done with it in the U.S. at that time. But as far as small-scale production, the Europeans still had it back then, and it had died out here. So they became my models in trying to figure out what we might do to continue to produce as long into the fall and as early in the spring. And the more we played with those ideas, finally we brought the late fall together with the early spring, and voila, the end of winter.
Voila, so to speak. So essentially, you know, I've seen them as kind of a dome shape, and I've seen them as kind of more of a tapered roof kind of structure. It's kind of a greenhouse, really, isn't it?
Basically, it is a greenhouse. The ones we have here have a Gothic arch shape to their roof rather than the round Quonset shape because they shed snow better, and we get a lot of snow here in the winter. The round shape, you get 3 feet of wet snow on top of one of those, and an awful lot of them will cave in on you. With the Gothic arch shape, which is a pointed top, it sheds the snow and is far more resistant to that winter pressure.
Tim Myers, I want to break in at this point and ask you about in Bethel with a high tunnel. How in the world do you secure that? You get some pretty ferocious winds there.
Yeah, and I was real skeptical when they first started coming out with that program a few years ago and really didn't want to be involved with trying to maintain something like that. But these things are impressive. I have two of them now, and I have no issues whatsoever with the wind. That when it gets cold, that plastic even shrinks a little tighter on these frames, and it's taut. And like Elliot says, I don't get the snow shed off the high tunnel like I would hope, is only because I think it's freezing. It sticks to it. It doesn't. There's no heat inside, so it doesn't slide off. But all these greenhouses in this agriculture greenhouse plastic is bulletproof to the wind. I mean, it's amazing stuff. It doesn't tear.
Oh, I'm just worried about structural stress, though. I mean, you got something poking up in the air, and I know from trying to pitch a tent when it's when it has those flexible poles you have to put in there. You get a couple of those in, and all of a sudden you have a parachute, and it's flying all over the place. And
yeah, but Steve, these aren't flexible. These are inch and a half diameter solid pipe that's been bent into the shape that you need to make the tunnel.
So you want to be sure you got a good end solid.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, no, the manufacturers of these buildings have been doing this long enough that they've figured out how to make sure that they stay in place when you put them in place, as long as you put them up correctly.
Our telephone number is 1-800-478-8255, 1-800-478-TALK. If calling from Anchorage, it's a local call, 550-8422. Email is talk@alaskapublic.org. And we're talking about problems of the short Alaska growing season. If you're just joining the program, coming over from the presidential media appearance today, welcome to the show. We've got Elliot Coleman of Four Season Farm in Maine. He'll be here for the Alaska Botanical Garden's 6th Annual Spring Garden Conference, Extend the Season, Expand Your Mind. Also, Tim Myers, who has been at the Garden Conference in years in the past and will be again this year, of Myers Farm in Bethel. He's producing food in Bethel. And Julianne McGinnis, Executive Director of the Alaska Botanical Garden. So the telephone number, 1-800-478-8255, 478-TALK, a local call in Anchorage at 550-8422, email talk@alaskapublic.org. And so far, it's been emails coming in. This one from Bruce Wright, who's been a guest on this program and is senior scientist with the Aleutian Pribilof Islands Association. He says, extending the growing season or even being successful gardening in some Alaska regions requires controlled environment agriculture, also called greenhouses, as we've been discussing. And the small village of St. George has been very successful with a 25-foot diameter windfast geodesic dome, and the 25 residents have fresh greens 6 months without the use of any electricity. He says it's time for the legislature to step up, and I prepared a proposal to that effect. And Julianne is nodding her head. It does seem that there is interest, at least, in the legislature in food security. Are you involved with the food security issue here?
Only peripherally. You know, I'm very interested in it and follow it. As a lifelong food gardener, it's near and dear to me. But I also think the lines between gardening and farming are blurring as people, as the economy and other factors, you know, cause people to want to grow more healthy food in their own homes, in their own yards, whether they have a lot of land or not. So you hear a lot about urban farming these days. So I think the lines are definitely blurring and people care at all levels. So,
well, we've seen that there's a lot of room for barter for sure. My neighbor's got chickens, you know, and I've got squashes. when you get your squashes, you definitely get your squashes, you know. And I'm not necessarily going to want to go rent out a booth at the, at the farmers markets. But my heavens, isn't that something in our town in Anchorage? How the farmers market thing has caught on?
It's exploded.
And they're all successful. Mm-hmm. And now we've got a year round even going on in the Sears Mall where they're selling local stuff even now in the middle of winter.
Absolutely. And I know gardeners who are gardening on their own little urban garden plot in Anchorage who are selling at farmers markets.
And here we are talking to Tim Myers, who's feeding Bethel. Tim, do you, you're a heavy equipment guy. Maybe you could talk about what you actually use there.
For opening up land?
Yeah.
Well, I really feel if we are going to be interested in food security in Alaska, and you look at the options we have around the state to do this, removing spruce forests and turning it into ag land is a pretty difficult project, I'm assuming, not ever doing that, but out here to strip off the tundra, I use a D6. You can strip several acres in no time at all and let the land thaw.
So once you've changed the structure of the permafrost, that you find that it will then melt in. I mean, that's certainly what they find when they start doing the airstrips. They have to insulate those things if they want to keep them frozen.
Well, see, I never done that. I think that's what everybody's done in the past, is trying to keep it frozen, and I've actually tried to thaw it out. And after a few years of thawing, and on the higher points of the property, I'm now digging down in the ground and putting buildings. I got a barn down in the ground now, and I'm producing eggs. I'm producing 120 dozen eggs a month right now in the dead of winter, and I'm growing meat birds. I get 25 chicks every other week, and you get down in the ground's fairly warm, and all of a sudden you can do all this stuff at really acceptable costs.
So you are putting some heat in there then?
Well, this building where I'm raising poultry, I think I'm burning about a half gallon a day.
Wow.
And, you know, if you look around the state, there's probably, I heard, up to maybe 1,000 people keeping birds this winter, but everybody really doesn't anticipate getting a lot of egg production during the winter. And, Jesus, I've got this facility where if I get 100 birds next year, I'm going to be putting out 250 dozen eggs a month. And if I start raising meat birds 40, 50 a week and all of this, I'm finding out the more birds I get, the less fuel I'm using. And you could never even comprehend trying to do this above ground out here, but down in the ground. I was just down there. I got new chicks on Friday. I got 25 more. And out there is take off my coat, and it's enjoyable. It's the first thing I do when I get out there is take off my coat, and it's enjoyable. It's warm. It's easy to heat. This being down in the ground is an alternative energy that we haven't even considered.
So to explain it to me, is it like a bunker, or have you actually got everything below ground level? I mean, could I tell there was a structure there when I walked up to it, or would I just see just hatch opening up into the ground?
No, it's the barn itself is a three-story building, the third floor being above ground, the second floor being in this hill that I built around it, and I'm actually able to drive up to the top of the third floor or into the bottom of the third floor, and the first floor down underground is where I've got all these meat birds now. My laying hens are on the second floor in the side of this hill. We had record colds all winter long. I've never had one frozen egg or frozen water in that barn all winter. I did have some eggs freeze, though, that were in my egg washing room. I take the eggs from the barn every day into this room where I wash, and it's under my house that's sort of on the ground, above the ground, and we have heat in there, and I've actually had eggs freeze in there, but I've never had them freeze in the barn.
Julianne McGinnis, do you have any experience with the high tunnels yet?
No, and I actually had a question for Tim and Elliot. As a home gardener, I don't have land to farm, much to my own dismay, but, I've experimented with cold frames and visqueen and various little pop-up greenhouses and that sort of thing. But how can we adapt these successful techniques to the home gardener situation?
Well, we have a small plastic-covered greenhouse that we built ourselves in our garden. It's 10 feet by 12 feet, and right now it's filled with kale and leeks and some overwintered Swiss chard and spinach, which we've been eating. And the nice thing about it, we built it ourselves from a one-inch conduit, or we could have used a chain-link fence top bar, which every Home Depot or Lowe's sells, and one of the bending forms sold by the Johnny's Selected Seeds catalog. And they allow you to turn these straight lengths of 10-foot-long pipe into curved shapes that gives you a homemade backyard greenhouse. It's very simple, and it's going to do a great job for you.
Johnny's got a fence bender.
And actually, Elliot developed that, I believe. Am I wrong about that, Elliot?
Oh, I imagined that there had to be something like that, and I found the guy in Texas who had designed one, and that's what's now being sold.
That's great. Are you in touch regularly with Johnny's? They're kind of in your neck of the woods.
Oh, yeah. Rob Johnson's an old friend of mine and one of the most wonderful people in the seed business.
Well, it's one of the most wonderful seed companies anybody's ever thought of.
Yeah, no, they do a great job. They have a wonderful range of tools as well as seeds. They're the small-scale producer's friend, that's for sure.
We got this question for whoever wants to handle it from Seldovia. Chris and Amy say, will high tunnels help with root maggots? How to deal with root maggots? Well, all three of you probably have something to say about that. Do you have root maggots out there in Bethel? You must, Tim.
Yeah, that's my biggest enemy. I have them with, you know, and all my cold crops that we use for storage, except for the potatoes, are basically root maggots. And the simplest solution is row cover. We get the stuff planted, and you buy this floating row cover, and you get the edges buried, and it really eliminates them.
Now, I thought they were from some kind of fly. That's not right?
They are.
And
yes, they are.
But you're saying a ground barrier.
A floating row cover.
What's that?
Floating row cover. We plant a lot of our crops in the spring and cover them. A lot of them we cover with plastic, but the ones that are affected by the root maggots we'll cover with this floating row cover and bury the edges of it, which don't allow the flies to get in to lay their eggs to create the problem.
Oh, I see what you're talking about. When you say floating it, that's like another form of plastic?
Yes.
Tell me, Julianne.
Some types are called remay. It's kind of a woven fabric that's breathable. And that's why they call it floating, because it's kind of light and breathable.
And it goes over top of your...
It goes direct over the crops. And,
I see.
You know, the pests have a life cycle, so you can, once you become familiar with your pests, you can understand their life cycle and know when to have the row cover on and when you can take it off.
Ah.
But row cover also has the advantage of adding some heat to the crop growing area.
Anything to add, Elliot?
Well, I'm just curious to ask Tim whether he's talking about carrot maggots or cabbage maggots or onion maggots or which one.
Well, you know, I believe we've only got one. I really don't have much of a problem with them with the cabbage anymore as I do the turnips and the radishes, or the big attractors at this point. I call them root maggots. I wouldn't be able to tell the difference between... I've done onions quite a bit. I have never had a problem with maggots with them. It's just really
The turnips and the radishes. Yeah. Yeah,
right.
That's your standard old cabbage family root maggot. One thing we've found is a little extra nitrogen helps the plants grow past that, and that's actually an old secret that people discovered years ago.
That can be fairly easy to do in Alaska.
Yeah, well, try a little dried blood or something out there and see if, on a trial basis, see if that makes a difference.
Yeah, I think fish is pretty good for that, too.
Or fish, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. We get
Well, I use lots of fish, but sometimes I think that attracts the flies.
Oh, that's interesting. Different places, different techniques.
Right.
But you say dried blood, huh?
Yeah.
I'm all of a sudden I'm slaughtering these chickens every week, and I'm ending up with buckets and buckets of congealed blood that I'm not sure what to do with. I should figure out a way to possibly dry that, I guess.
Man, I enjoy agriculture shows. I have to tell you.
And then there's
brings out the six-year-old in me.
Then we have our charismatic megafauna up here that'll love that dried blood.
Whoa! Our telephone number, 1-800-478-8255, 478-TALK. Let's go to Jason, joins the program from McCarthy, Alaska. Welcome to Talk of Alaska, Jason.
Well, hey, thank you for having me on. I appreciate you're having these discussions there, Steve. I really like it's refreshing. I'd much rather talk to my neighbors about food security and gardening than listening to the politics on the other side of the planet. So thank you on that one. The couple things I wanted to mention on the backwoods style, willow makes really nice bases for high tunnels, and it's a pretty amazing, like I said, what a little bit of visqueen will do. It's nice to have the high quality stuff, which sort of leads to the other one. It's just enrolled in the high tunnel program myself for my farmstead, and it'd be nice to see a state program like that. It's so simple. And it just strikes me that very little funding, and we could protect and increase our production, Kenny Lake Delta, the Valley, all over the state, dramatically within a single season. They're so easy to put up and get with the program.
It seems like just not to interrupt or anything, Jason, but that seems like something that the Food Policy Council ought to be looking at. I mean, that's why they're there.
Yeah. Right now, it seems a garden in every yard. You know, we've got state right of ways that would make wonderful grazing grounds with electric fences. There's we're so close to food sustainability within our own culture, within our own resources, as we speak within a single season. It's sort of hard to see, especially to see people on the other side of the planet not having any food. You know, it's a tough one. But just for the neighborhood and for all our local neighbors, I'd really like to see this conversation engaged more strongly. And it's just so exciting to hear you guys hear it talked and discussed. And you know, what about maggots? What about using different plants to bring in? What are all these resources to pull in, you know?
You know, you reminded me just now that community gardening, even in towns and I won't use the term urban areas because a lot of Alaska is not urban, but whether you're in a town or a larger urban area, there's the option of community-supported gardening. We have a talk at our conference this weekend on community-supported gardening. Darren Snyder from Juneau is going to come up and talk about some of the successes that they've had in Juneau, as well as segue into some discussions of Anchorage community gardening with the Anchorage Community Land Trust.
Wow. Thank you. Yeah. Thanks for your call from
Anchorage Garden's been going really strong for years now. That's got a lot of participation. I'm sure that community would love to expand. In fact, if you get into that community, you'll find people there sort of scuffling their feet that they didn't sign up in time. Like, if there's more land for them to work, they'd be more than happy to be out there working it.
You know, Jason, I was just thinking about the BP building on Benson Boulevard, and they have this nice Scottish grass that they're growing on there right now. I mean, there's got to be like 4 or 5 acres of that. what if it was under cultivation and doing something besides producing that weird grass they're making? Just a thought as Talk of Alaska continues.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from First National Bank Alaska, helping Alaska's dreams grow since 1922. On the web at fnbalaska.com, an equal housing lender, member FDIC. Primera Blue Cross Blue Shield of Alaska, providing quality health plans to companies and individuals in Alaska for over 60 years. More at primera.com. Primera Blue Cross Blue Shield of Alaska. We know the territory. And by the Alaska Budget Report, providing in-depth coverage for state governments since 1991, on the web at akbudgetreport.com.
It's Talk of Alaska, and if you're just joining the program, we'll tell you that we're talking about the fact that Alaska has a short growing season, but how can we extend it? And it's one of many programs we've done about food security and gardening and being outside and engaging with the natural world. And it's exciting, and it's fun. And we've got a call from Sam and Kenny Lake about root maggots, but Sam, before we put you on, I want to just talk to one of our guests here, Elliot Coleman of Four Season Farm in Maine. Is it true that the Four Season Farm is actually part of the old Nearing Back to the Land farm?
Yeah, when Scott and Helen left Vermont in the early 50s, they moved to Maine and they bought 140 acres here near the coast. And back in 1968, I'd become friends with them after reading their book, Living the Good Life, and they sold me 60 acres of the back half of their farm, and they sold it to me for what they'd paid for it 20 years before because they wanted to help a young fellow who wanted to get into farming.
So there you are, farming a piece of the Nearing's place. I mean, I don't know how many people. I think maybe people were reading that real heavily in the 1960s. That's when I came across it. And as far as I'm concerned, they're of absolute mythic dimensions, the Nearings. I could hardly even imagine such people existed. And I'm so jealous of you that you actually got to have a relationship with them.
Oh, they were just wonderful people, and they'd been everywhere and done everything, and they always did whatever they did as well as it could be done. And it wasn't like it was easy because the 60 acres I bought was all wooded. So we've got 14 acres cleared now, but it took a while of chopping and grubbing out stumps to get us where we are.
Oh, yeah, stumps. And that's serious Maine hardwoods, too. Yeah. Well, let's go to Sam, joins the program from Kenny Lake. Welcome to Talk of Alaska, Sam.
Well, thank you. It's a wonderful program you're having here. My sister visited Scott Nearing's place, and when she saw my place, she said, well, you've got more going than Scott Nearing does, but he didn't have the livestock that I did. But I've slowed down. But on the root maggots, when I first started to garden here, and I had a wonderful garden on the edge of the bluff at Rabbit Creek, that was almost as good as Pennsylvania. Anyway, on the root maggots, they warned me that they come from a moth that is native to us, and that they flourish on the mustard plant that grows wild here. So they're part of the scenery, and there was no particular remedy at that time, but I have used the floating row covers, and I plant the turnips and the radishes together, and I leave it there for months, and then all of a sudden I reach under it and see what I got, and I take it all off and harvest a bushel of radishes and let the turnips grow. Now, I called. I never had a problem with onions. I thought they were immune to them. But all of a sudden, I had a terrible infestation of them in the onions, and I called the seed company, and they told me what horrible stuff that I had to use. And I said, well, I'm doing organic, and he hung up on me. But I have a suspicion that ashes will retard them, because I always used to use ashes on my garden, and somebody says, oh, no, you shouldn't use ashes. So I said, well, I guess I don't have to, because I had plenty of manure. But then I noticed at the time I stopped using ashes is when the root maggots began to get so bad. And I'm thinking, I'll go back to ashes again. I think the potassium in the ashes may discourage them. And this is a great program, and I hope to hear more about these sorts of things, and I'll get off the air now.
All right, Sam, thanks a lot for your tip there, and let's go to Don now, joins the program from Homer. Welcome to Talk of Alaska, Don.
Hey, this one's for Elliot, and thanks for having the show on. Elliot, are you going to be able to bring Barbara along with you when you come to town, and make sure you bring lots of books and DVDs for all the folks that are...
Yeah, no, I won't be able to bring Barbara. One of us has to stay here and look after the farm, so it's just going to be me on this trip.
And Barbara, your spouse is was associated with Victory Garden, right?
She was a reporter on the Victory Garden program, and back in the 90s, we had our own TV program called Gardening Naturally. And then Barbara's written a book called The Garden Primer, which outsells mine by a lot.
I guess she reminds me
of that constantly.
I guess while we're plugging away, we ought to talk about Jeff Lowenfeld's also going to be at the annual meeting and Spring Garden Conference of the Alaska Botanical Garden. Jeff is the past president of Garden Writers of America and so forth, pretty well-known gardening guy here in Alaska. And all across the country, really, the crazy, imaginative Jeff. And Jeff has gone so organic, he's way beyond me.
Yeah, I had a question for Elliot about deep organics. Could you elaborate a little bit on what you mean by deep organics and how deep organic techniques might differ from standard organic techniques?
Right. Well, I just I stole that word from the ecology people, like deep and shallow ecology. And the early days when the USDA got involved in organic, what I saw was mostly organic being defined as what it didn't do. We don't do these bad things. We don't use pesticides. We don't use chemicals. And I thought organic should be defined by what it is doing, the positive steps it's making to create more fertile soil, to save the soil, to prevent erosion and so forth. And in the process, by working to create a superior soil, to grow more nutritious vegetables because they have all the trace elements and other parts they're supposed to have. And so I thought the organic would be better defined by what it does than by the sins that it doesn't commit. And I just thought the easiest way to do that was to refer to what I do as deep organic rather than shallow organic.
Yeah. And do you go so far as being biodynamic?
No, I've read all the material. I've visited lots of biodynamic farms, which I always thought were excellently run. I just have never taken that next step. I don't know whether I am too much of a scientist to accept many of those concepts on a belief system. But anybody who's trying hard to create an exceptionally fertile soil by adding in the parts that Mother Nature should have put there but didn't get around to is doing the job that needs to be done as far as growing healthier food for everybody to eat.
I will say it. There was a session I went to in Vancouver at the American Association for the Advancement of Science that was centered on how do we get to 350, which is the 350 ppm of carbon dioxide, which we're above right now, but which Jim Hansen contends is the level we should be aiming for if we want to not kill off a whole lot of our planet. And this was a very wide-ranging half a day session with experts from all different angles, Hansen himself, but one thing that particularly attracted me was the guy who had organized it and a colleague of his were both from Cornell. And they were both, I mean, Cornell is one of our land-grant colleges in the country, and for people that are not acquainted with the history of agriculture, these land-grant colleges spread the gospel of chemical fertilizers and the gospel of the various tilling techniques and so on. And one thing that they were pushing as an amazing carbon repository is simply no-till agriculture. Who knew? I mean, actually, you can get a lot of carbon into the ground simply by not using the tilling method of agriculture. And this is coming from a land-grant college now.
Right. Well, you can also put a lot of carbon in the ground by having your livestock fed on grass on a grazing system rather than feeding them on grain, since grain requires tillage.
Yeah. Let's go to Brian, joins the program from Talkeetna. Welcome to Talk of Alaska, Brian.
Hello, and first I'll say a quick hi to Julianne, a longtime friend from back here.
Hey, Brian.
I see that you're on the other side of the radio interview today.
Yeah, it's fun.
My family has a Birch Creek Ranch, which was started as a part of the original agricultural land disposal program in the 80s. Touch base on a few of our successes, which goes to the, I don't know if it's maybe even a part of the history of the High Tunnel. We started building arch greenhouses from some simple plans we found. I think they may have be originated on the East Coast using one-bys to form an arch with blocks to glue and screws, and some of these are now easily 20 years old. We have three of them. We also have the High Tunnel, I know there's some discussion of the difference between the greenhouse and the High Tunnel, and the way the program is specified, the High Tunnels, you're not allowed to heat them. And I always understood the greenhouse is you were really controlling the environment, you know, with active heating and ventilation, whereas the High Tunnel is more of a cold frame where you're you're using only passive methods.
Yeah, actually, very at the beginning of the program, which is a part that because of the president still being on the air, a lot of people missed. We had Elliot give an explanation of that, and I think I'll call on him to go into more detail about that here, Brian.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So just stay on the line here. And Elliot, as I understood it, you were saying, yeah, you basically have the high tunnel, but then you also have a second layer inside, right?
Well, yeah. Well, what Brian is saying is correct. Usually people assume that if it's a greenhouse, you're putting heat in. And an unheated, simple plastic-covered structure called a high tunnel is the unheated approach. What we found out was you can really improve the winter protection of an unheated high tunnel by putting a second layer of plastic. We use one of the floating row covers that Julianne was talking about earlier, held a foot above the ground on wire wickets. And that greenhouse inside the greenhouse makes an enormous difference and truly increases the range of different crops that will survive even the harshest, coldest winters.
Okay. Okay. And that kind of gets to my second thought on those is where we have our arch greenhouses, we keep the plastic on. And with the high tunnels, we have to take that off because we don't get the snow shedding. And even our greenhouses here, we've shoveled them down to 8 feet above the ground twice now this winter. and other greenhouses that were similarly built in the area have collapsed. So maybe that's a sign of the winter. But we have the greenhouses heating them. And unfortunately, we're burning a lot of dinosaur juice, and that's our biggest challenge to try and make it a viable operation. We can't put that plastic on the high tunnel until, you know, the end of April, and we have to have the plants, you know, we have them started now, and we're, you know, staring at opening up our greenhouse and starting to heat it within the next couple of weeks. We'd normally have it started already, but just because of the fuel costs, we're trying to push that back as much as possible, and so that's obviously a big challenge. With a greenhouse, you have to let the light in, and Tim had his chickens down buried in the ground, but that doesn't let the light in. We can't do that for a greenhouse, unfortunately.
One way you can cut your heating bills, and you certainly have as much of it up there as we do in Maine, is with the wood system. And there are a number of wood boiler systems that store the heat that you create by the wood fire during the day in large insulated plastic tubs, and then that hot water is pumped around to your greenhouse at night, and that way you can only run the heater during the day when you're over there and start it up again the next morning. And that's been very successful in many places in New England.
Yeah, I'm actually looking to try and build something like that using the new rocket stove concept.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, exactly.
In our particular case, we don't have the electric power either. So it's an additional challenge to do something that is lower in the use of electricity, because that gets us. We got the double whammy trying to survive in the edge.
Brian, thanks for that reality check there. It's Talk of Alaska, problems of the short Alaska growing season as Talk of Alaska continues.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from BP, supporting public broadcasting in Alaska. First National Bank Alaska, helping Alaska's dreams grow since 1922. On the web at fnbalaska.com, an equal housing lender, member FDIC. And by Providence Imaging Center, with three locations, including its newest center in Soldotna, offering CT scans, MRI, and digital X-rays to residents on the Kenai Peninsula. Learn more at provimaging.com.
Extend the season, expand your mind is the theme of the Alaska Botanical Garden's 6th annual Spring Garden Conference. And we're kind of rambling over some of the subjects that'll be talked about there with some of the people that would be there to talk about it. Notably, Tim Myers of Myers Farm in Bethel, Elliot Coleman of Four Season Farm in Maine. He's kind of the high tunnel guy, and Julianne McGinnis, executive director of the Alaska Botanical Garden. And one of the reasons she ever was interested in that job is because she loves to garden. And by email, Danny Constantine of the USDA joins in here to say, here's a good site to find information about USDA, U.S. Department of Agriculture, grants, loans, and other support for small farmers, a new interactive map at, and then we will go ahead and put that link up on our website, and also the website for the Alaska Food Policy Council, both good things to stay in touch with. There's tremendous interest in this, and I think the Food Policy Council can be an instrument for actually getting into the policy area and maybe hurrying some things up that are very much needed if we get some consensus about what we need. Tim Myers, are you involved at all with the Food Policy Council? I know you're not real big on bureaucracy.
I would love to be, just have never really contacted them or heard of them, really.
Yeah, well, they're just getting going, so we'll see. Let's go to Marion in Kenai. Welcome to Talk of Alaska, Marion.
Hi, good morning. Thanks for having this program on, and hello to Julianne and Tim. It's wonderful always to hear what you have to say. And looking forward to the Botanical Garden Conference again, but I wanted to plug that Tim will be coming to Homer just after the conference with the Homer Garden Club, and then on the 13th to the Kenai Soldotna area for our monthly program on the evening of the 13th, and hanging out to visit some high tunnel growers and talk about land use in the borough and blah blah blah, various other things. So we're very excited to have Tim visit us again. We call him Alaska's agricultural rock star, and I believe that he truly is.
Tim, who takes care of the farm when you're gone?
My wife and daughter.
Oh, well, you got to have a family. I mean, I guess that's why they call it family farming, huh?
Yeah, well, that keeps you tied down. And I don't know if that's the farm or the family.
Well, I mean, I know a little bit about chickens, and you can't really go off and leave chickens for very long.
No, well, we got the produce stand. We've got all this stuff we're dealing with full time, so someone has to be here to do all this.
So where is the produce stand?
I don't know if you've been to Bethel. We're on the northwest corner of Bethel, and the farm is there, and we have it located right here on the farm.
I see.
It was supposed to have gone downtown. We were going to put it down downtown, which might have been a little better for the public, but at the last minute it ended up here on the farm, and it's definitely easier for us having it. It's, 75 feet from the root cellar, so we store everything in the root cellar and move it up to the produce stand every morning.
It's just a short walk.
Yeah,
Marion, you still with us in Kenai?
I am. I have a Rick Maggot comment, too. Last summer, we had a garden tour that went down to Nanilchik to Dolores Lindemans, and she has an absolutely fabulous, she and her family have a fabulous garden full of compost, just picture perfect, really. Just absolutely wonderful. Anyway, her method of dealing with root maggots is to glue, like a spot of glue, a cotton ball or some cotton balls at the base of those cold crops, and took care of it because the fly will lay their eggs in that, and of course they don't go anywhere in cotton balls. So it's
wow
for her. And we were wondering what these little white tufts were at the base of, say, broccoli or whatever, and she shared that with us. So some people have thought, well, I wonder if we took some cotton batting, just like you get for wounds and so forth, and just put it around the base of a plant. But anyway, Dolores did it with cotton balls, so that's good enough for me.
Decoy. I had no idea.
Decoy.
I mean, yeah, we
decoy.
Kind of think of our radishes as decoys for the root maggots because, they just sort of seem to attract them. So we kind of write off a lot of radishes.
Time, they do attract them, but at the same time, they encourage them. So this just sort of, this and maybe this and row cover would really be a double whammy for them.
So tell us again, Marion, your event there in Kenai.
Yeah, Tim will be speaking again to us. He was here last year and such a hit. We're just excited as heck to have him back. The Homer Club and the Kenai Club, the garden clubs, are helping a little bit with bringing Tim to the Botanical Garden Conference and So turnabout is fair play, and he's coming down to the peninsula for a few days each after that, visiting various growers here, and we'll be just thrilled to have him again. And always glad to hear about Tim's family being so involved with the farm. It's, you know, it is a family farm situation, and they are doing an absolutely wonderful job and setting the pace for the rest of us to study and copy as much as we can.
Great. Tim, you're really getting praised here.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
He deserves it. He deserves it.
Well, Julianne, maybe you can tell us like the location of your...
Sure. So on Friday night, we have our annual meeting that kind of kicks off our spring garden conference, and that's at the Anchorage Museum starting at 6:30. And Elliot Coleman will be speaking at that about extending the season. If we can do it in Maine, you can do it in Alaska. Elliot will speak again, kind of capping the day on Saturday. We have an all-day series of four tracks of four sessions each on Saturday. Doors open at 8:30, and that's at the UAA APU Consortium Library. And there's talks on everything from beneficial insects to wild food foraging for Alaska's wild edibles to compost and mycorrhizal fungi, to personal scale urban farming, growing herbs, Alaska's native medicine cabinet, and dahlias, and many others. So Elliot's going to speak on Saturday about organic farming, the next steps. And again, that's at the UAA APU Consortium Library. But the Friday evening talk is definitely at the Anchorage Museum.
And you got Jeff Lowenfels doing compost.
Yeah, Jeff's going to tell us some new information about those wonderful fungi and the mycorrhizae. His topic is compost and mycorrhizal fungi. It's our turn now.
Okay, this is from Liza. I'm new to Fairbanks in Alaska. What would be the best way for a newbie to start out here? I've gardened in New York, but not here, and I don't have much of a yard. Thanks for the radio show, but it is a bit scary for someone starting out. It sounds like there's a lot more to think about. You better believe it. I think the best thing you can do, Liza, is talk to your neighbors who are growing things, because you have a lengthy periods in the summertime when you just have this endless sunlight. But microclimate is one thing I learned moving here from temperate. Microclimate is everything. Even like where rocks are is important, where walls are. It's each square yard of ground is different from each other square yard of ground, and you have to kind of learn all of this. But I think local knowledge, especially in Alaska growing, is really important. And we always find people, when we do this subject on the show, they're more than happy to share their knowledge, and they actually really want to share their knowledge. Well, I want to thank everybody for being with us. And once again, extend the season, expand your mind. We'll be back to this subject. Julianne, thank you so much.
Thank you, Steve.
Elliot Coleman, looking forward to meeting you.
Thank you, Steve.
All right. And Tim, glad to have you back.
Thank you much.
All right. Stock of Alaska, thanks once again to Dave Waldron and Josh Edge. I'm Steve Heimel.
Talk of Alaska is made possible by this member station of the Alaska Public Radio Network, by Wells Fargo, providing financial tools and resources for purchasing a home or planning for the future, Wells Fargo Bank, N.A., and by the Pebble Partnership, developing a comprehensive mine plan that meets Alaska's regulatory requirements while supporting sustainable fisheries in Southwest Alaska, pebblepartnership.com. This program is a production of APRN, which is solely responsible for its content. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of APRN, this station, or its underwriters. Today's program is available online at alaskapublic.org. CD copies are available by calling 550-8400.